From KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this show on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. The Syrian Democratic Forces, or SDF, with the backing of the U.S. military, have declared the northern Syrian city of Raqqa liberated from the Islamic State. The SDF is dominated by Kurdish YPG forces. The Raqqa situation unfolded within days of Iraqi forces retaking the northern Iraqi city of Kirkuk from Kurdish Peshmerga forces. U.S. military units are on the ground there attempting to stop a brewing conflict between Iraqi forces loyal to Baghdad and Kurdish fighters, both of which have received the support of the U.S. 3 weeks ago, a Kurdish referendum passed overwhelmingly in favor of independence in Iraq, but the U.S., which has historically backed Kurds, has called the vote, quote, illegitimate. Joining me to help sort it all out is Kani Zulam. He's the director of the American Kurdish Information Network. Welcome to the program, Kani.
Thanks for having me, Sonali.
So first, because the situation in Raqqa is in the news, let's start there and then turn to Iraq. In Raqqa, the Syrian Democratic Forces is basically a group of a conglomeration of various forces, I understand, but the main sort of leading force within the SDF is the Kurdish YPG forces. And the Kurdish fighters have shown to be the most effective so far in dealing with the Islamic State incursions in Syria and Iraq. So how significant is what's happening in Raqqa right now?
Well, it's very significant. That victory has brought a smile to our face. Yesterday's debacle in Kirkuk, unfortunately, saddened us across the world, all the Kurds and their friends. In Syria, Islamic State is living its last days, and unfortunately, will go underground. It doesn't mean it's the end of it, but at least they don't have a state anymore, and it's a very, very significant victory for the Kurds as well as their friends inside Syria.
And what is the sort of approach, if you will, that has been so effective that Kurdish forces have been able to use against the Islamic State? The YPG have succeeded where previous attempts have failed.
Well, YPG's gender equality in terms of having women fighters, YPG's tolerance of other groups in terms of cultivating them using them. I mean, not using them, but urging them to, transform Syria, make it a better country. And the fact that Uncle Sam is helping, all these combination of factors have made them irresistible. And they are the ones who didn't run away in Kobani in 2014, and they have been succeeding ever since, and finally, thankfully, mercifully, the end of ISIS is coming.
So you feel pretty confident that at least in Syria, ISIS is not going to have enough of a foothold anymore, and they may be simply driven underground?
I think so, yeah. Raqqa was their capital, Mosul was their most important city. Both are gone now, officially. There are some pockets here and there. But they can see the writing on the wall. My hunch is they will go underground. They'll go into their bunkers, if you will. This is it. This is, as a state, they are. We can raise rest in peace sign over it.
Let's put a historical context to the role that Kurdish militias have played in Syria, but also mostly largely in Iraq. For those people who are not aware, who sort of feel like they need a Kurdish history 101, explain the way in which various Kurdish groups in Iraq, Syria, and Turkey have for decades now fought for their own independent Kurdistan, and over the course of various conflicts received U.S. funding and support, and tried to use that Western backing to make the case for their own state.
Well, the Kurds, unfortunately, Kurdistan was partitioned at the end of the First World War by the victors of the First World War, namely Great Britain and France. Up until then, they had an autonomous region in Ottoman Empire and also in Persian Empire. Both empires were weak, both empires were decrepit. So the Kurds pretty much ran their own show, they were pretty much independent, pretty much free, but they didn't have a state of their own. With the advent of the nation state coming to the Middle East, Syria was created out of thin air, so was Iraq, Palestine, Jordan, by Great Britain and France. And then there was this resurgence of nationalism on the part of Turks and Persians. All of a sudden, Kurdish language was banned. All of a sudden, Kurdish culture was disdained. All of a sudden, Kurdish songs were prohibited. And so we naturally fought back. And we have been fighting, for the last 100 years now. In Iraq, we had made some advances up until yesterday with the debacle in Kirkuk. Unfortunately, we have had a major setback now. In Syria, with the victory over ISIS in Raqqa, that's a major victory. The Kurds basically want greater political space. Ideally, they would like to have a state of their own. The Kurds in Iraq on September 25, they had a referendum. 73% of the people voted. Of those, of that percentage, 92% of the people had said they want to be free of Arab Iraq.
Let's talk about that a little bit in more detail, because that sets the stage for what may have unfolded in Kirkuk. Who called that referendum? And who were the people that were allowed to vote? We're basically talking about only Iraqi Kurds voting in this referendum, asking for independence within Iraq?
Well, the referendum, the statement on the ballot was, would you like to see independence? Would you like to be free as Kurdistan to be a state? And of the 73% that voted, 92% said yes. So it was, a good mandate, but it wasn't a declaration.
But just for Iraqi Kurds.
That's right.
Yeah.
It wasn't a declaration of independence. Okay. It was a declaration of intent. And the Kurdish leadership said, this gives us a mandate. We have issues with the central government in Baghdad. We have, for example, something called disputed territories. We have, for example, the fate of Kirkuk, which, if you check the British records in 1920s, it shows that, the British weren't friends of the Kurds. They simply had a colony called Iraq, created a colony called Iraq. And then they had a census. And if you check those records, Kirkuk is predominantly Kurdish. Yes, it has an Arab minority, and yes, it has a Turkmen minority and Jewish and Christian minority. But the character of the city was Kurdish. That's the British records. And that went on during the British colonial experience, as well as after when the monarchy was toppled. Then a monster called Saddam Hussein came to power. And there was oil under the soil of Kirkuk, and Kirkuk became a prize for the greedy politicians in Baghdad. So Saddam, for example, tried to ethnically cleanse it. He drove a lot of Kurds out of the city. He brought in a lot of Arabs from the south, and he also bribed them to bring the graves of their grandparents so that they could say, well, they've been here for generations. And that state of affairs went on until he was toppled in 2003. And then the Kurds came back, reclaimed their homes and their farms and their properties. And in 2005, the Kurds worked with the Arabs, and there was a constitution put together. And in that constitution, Article 140, for example, says because Kirkuk is contested, the central government will have a referendum in 2 years before 2007 is over to see if the city should be, the province should be part of Kurdistan region, or if it should be part of Arab Iraq, the state of Arab Iraq, the Arab region. The central government, I mean, the politicians in Baghdad, after the constitution was passed, basically slept on it, kicked the can down the road, didn't want to hold a referendum. They knew they would lose it. The Kurds had come back. And if you look at the composition of the city hall, for example, the majority of the aldermen were Kurds. And then the countryside was predominantly Kurdish. So the city, the government didn't want to hold that referendum because they knew they were going to lose it. On September 25, the Kurds had a referendum there, as well as in the other parts of Kurdistan, of Iraq. And since they got the mandate, the central government then decided to use force to take the city away from them.
So the actions in Kirkuk, you're saying, are a direct response to the result of the referendum 3 weeks ago.
That's right.
Okay.
Basically, a vote took place. A democratic experiment was, you know, undertaken. And the central government went, you know, crazy over the decision of the Kurds to take a poll. And then the neighbors of Kurdistan, or Kurds, Iran, Turkey, even Syria, as you know, on its back, if you will, made noises that, you know, this referendum is illegitimate, is wrong. Unfortunately,
and United Rex States, Tillerson, the U.S. Secretary of State, called it illegitimate as well.
Unfortunately, the United States joined them too. Somebody needed to remind Tillerson. The Declaration of Independence that was written by Thomas Jefferson was also illegitimate. So, you know, things came to a blow yesterday. And unfortunately, there were Kurdish forces loyal to Talabani family who basically worked out a deal with the central government. They abandoned their posts. And then the Kurds were shocked to see, you know, Iraqi army behind them, if you will. And so they withdrew to Hawler, to Erbil, the capital.
And how significant has Kirkuk been for Kurds? How long have they held? How long have Kurdish forces, and these are the Peshmerga forces in Iraq, how long have they held that city before it was basically taken over by Iraqi forces this week?
Well, the city was contested during Saddam's time, but Kurds couldn't take it from Saddam. So in 2003, when Saddam was toppled, Kurds actually helped Americans to, you know, keep the Northern Army busy. And then when Saddam was toppled, the Kurds took over the city in 2003. The United States government, unfortunately, nudged the Kurds to leave it. They said that, you know, we want to transform Iraq. You know, when the British came there, they brought a monarchy. When Americans came to Iraq, they said, we are going to bring democracy. And they didn't want to, they wanted to please the Arabs who were rising up against the American domination. So they nudged the Kurds to leave Kirkuk in 2003 against their will. The Kurds didn't really want to leave it. But because Americans had you know, toppled Saddam, and so the Kurds had suffered from Saddam, the Kurds said, fine, we'll leave. So they left in 2003. For 11 years until 2014, it was in the hands of the central government in Baghdad, even though the Kurds then were allowed to come back. And the Kurds then had a governor, had through the local elections, as well as a mayor. But militarily, it was under the control of the central government. In August of 2014, when 1,500 ISIS cutthroats attacked Mosul and took over. And then when thousands of other Sunnis who were unhappy with the Shiite government in Baghdad joined the ranks of ISIS, they took over Kirkuk too. And they almost took over Baghdad, if you remember,
right,
in August 2014 and September 2014 and October 2014. It was a slew of victories, one after the other, town after town falling under the sway of ISIS fighters. The Kurds took back from ISIS. So they acted quick. So
the Kurds were instrumental in basically keeping the Islamic State from taking over big swaths of Iraq, is what you're saying.
That's right. They had a big border with ISIS as opposed to having a big border with Central Iraqi government. And so Kirkuk fell under the control of the Kurds, and from 2014, August 2014, until yesterday, it was controlled by the Kurdish military, Kurdish police, Kurdish security forces. Yesterday, it fell under the control of the central government. So the Kurds are no longer as a police force or military force are in Kirkuk. People have left. Yesterday, the pictures were heartbreaking, people fleeing.
And we're, by the way, talking with you on Tuesday. So what you're discussing happened on Monday. Yeah,
that's right. And the Kurds are afraid that the Hashbi Shabi, the militia group that is managed by Iran, supported by Iran, run by an Iranian general called Qasem Soleimani, they are afraid that, you know, these militia groups, not accountable to law, might hurt them, might harm them. So many of them have fled. It brings back to the memories of 1991 when Saddam attacked the Kurds and the Kurds fled to the mountains. So a lot of Kurds are very, very unhappy and very shocked, that includes me, about what happened yesterday. But it is what it is.
And I understand, Kani, that Iraqi forces have now taken over the oil fields from Kurdish control in Kirkuk, which, as you started our conversation in mentioning that oil was discovered under Kirkuk, this is a significant part of the whole equation too, right? That oil fields are now back under the control of central Iraqi government forces in Iraq.
That's right. You know, some of the blame actually goes to the British government. In 1908, they switched their navy. It used to run on coal. They switched it to oil. And they discovered oil in Iraq, in Kirkuk, and in Iran. So they wanted to keep Iraq together because they were benefiting from that oil, unfortunately. Otherwise, they might have let us be free of the Arab domination. But because oil was in Kirkuk and they needed that oil, we became, we sacrificial lamb. And then by the time the British left, the Arabs then didn't want to let go of that bridge, resource. And even today, yesterday's attack has to do with that oil. If there was no oil under the soil of Kirkuk, I don't think the Arabs, the central government, would have made the attempt. I don't think Iranians would have backed Iraq to take over the city. So that resource, unfortunately, has become the bone of contention between the Arab Iraq and the Kurdish Kurdistan.
So, Kani Zulam, let's talk about the U.S. role now. The U.S. has seduced Iraqi Kurdish aspirations, Kurds, using their aspirations for independent Kurdistan for many, many years. The U.S. has backed Kurdish forces, and now the U.S. is on the ground in Kirkuk, apparently trying to resolve the situation on the ground between Kurdish forces and central Iraqi forces. Is the U.S. an honest broker here?
U.S. has a checkered record. In the 70s, when Saddam was a nobody, when we were fighting him, U.S. initially supported us, but their intentions were not pure. They simply wanted to keep Saddam busy, unfortunately, for the sake of Israel. When Saddam then had an agreement with the Shah of Iran, U.S. abandoned us to the tender mercies of Saddam. Years later, Saddam then gassed us. U.S.
The famous gassing of Kurds that the U.S. then used. Yeah.
In 1988, the city of Halabja was gassed from the air by the Iraqi Air Force. Some 5,000 Kurds literally dropped dead like autumn leaves. But 280 other locales were attacked by chemical weapons. One in 20 Kurds were killed by Saddam. Close to 250,000 people in a population that's 5 million. So we were traumatized by Saddam. And when he was toppled by the U.S., we were grateful to U.S. U.S. hasn't really backed us per se. It has more used us, I would say. And unfortunately, our leadership hasn't seen to it that we shouldn't be used. that we should be, you know, if there are influence, I mean, if there are interests that dovetail U.S. interests and Kurdish interests in the toppling of Saddam, for example, fine, we could work together. But right now, U.S. wants Iraq to stay together, whereas we want Iraq to break up along, you know, ethnic lines, along the national lines.
So let's talk about that, because, of course, what you said earlier about U.S. intentions not being pure, I think, of course, a lot of communities, groups, ethnic groups have found over the years that U.S., the U.S.'s intentions are never pure. The U.S. always acts in its own interest. And do you think it's been to the detriment of various Kurdish forces at various times to have worked with the U.S., you know, given that in the end, the U.S. will do what the U.S. wants, and very rarely, unless interests align from right from the start to the very end, very rarely will the U.S. really work for the aspirations, legitimate democratic aspirations of any community?
They won't. U.S. has become a status quo power. U.S. is not a revolutionary power that it used to be in, you know, early 18th century. Today, it wants to, you know, benefit from a, you know, quote unquote, peaceful and quiet world. But Middle East is anything but peaceful, is anything but quiet. When you don't have, you know, 40 million Kurds, the right to speak their language, when the Kurds cannot, you know, establish their own institutions, like for example in Turkey, when the Kurds are, you know, not allowed to have universities in a place like Iran, for example, or high schools for that matter. So the way to address these things would be to, you know, work out, like nudge, let's say, the central government to work out its differences with the Kurds. When Kurds asked for a referendum, you know, U.S. didn't need to take a stand against it. It wasn't like we were saying we want to take over Baghdad. It wasn't like we were saying we want to take over Basra. We simply wanted, you know, a relationship based on equality, a relationship based on rule of law, a relationship based on, you know, that Kurds and Arabs could be neighbors with equal rights, not that the Arabs should have more rights and the Kurds have less rights, which is the source of conflict, which is the source of instability in Iraq. But U.S. unfortunately didn't do that. Yesterday, you know, if U.S. had nudged the central government in Baghdad, I don't think U.S. central government would have attacked the Kurds, taken over Kirkuk. It basically said, you know, we're actually President Trump, after the city had fallen, said, you know, we didn't want to take sides. Whereas
before, well, the U.S. has always taken sides, though.
Well, it took this, basically, it took the side of the strong. Exactly. It took the side of Baghdad. And if you really want to look at the historical context, Baghdad has been nothing but bad news for U.S. The 5,000 American, 6,000 American troops that died since the toppling of Saddam, they have all died in Arab Iraq. None of them have died in Kurdistan, in the north. I can tell you anecdotal, you know, stories. U.S. special forces coming back to the United States, coming to visit me in my office, saying, you know, when we went to Kurdistan, it was R&R. We rested and we relaxed. Whereas in Baghdad, in Basra, in Ramadi, in Hilla, we had to wear our armored, you know, vests so that we wouldn't be, you know, attacked from the back or from the front or from the side. U.S. has lost, the whole Iraq war became a debacle. And at least the Kurdish part was the functioning part, was the... Yes, we had problems, but compared to Arab Iraq, it was a source of stability. It's where now 1.2 million Arabs inside Iraq have sought refuge there because of the fight with ISIS. You know, thousands of Syrian Kurds as well as Syrian Arabs have sought refuge there. Close to 1.8 million refugees now live in Iraqi Kurdistan. And the international community could have, you know, honored our hospitality, could have recognized our desire to be a little bit more free. But, you know, the Security Council was against it. The U.S. was against it, as I said. I have to tell you, this is a recipe for instability. The warmongers, the people who sell arms are probably, you know, having good thoughts or rubbing their hands with one another, saying, great, we could sell more arms, we could sell more guns, we could sell more tanks, we could sell more armored vehicles, because the region is, you know, is unstable.
Well, Kani, I want to come back to the issue of the Islamic State. Does it seem to the Kurdish community that here you have Kurdish forces in both Iraq and Syria helping to lead, if not leading, the fight against the Islamic State most effectively, and in swoop in, you know, other forces to say, thank you very much, and now we're going to sweep you aside and reap the products of your victory?
Well, we definitely feel used. We definitely feel that, you know, this threat wasn't just against the Kurds. Yes, we were threatened too. Yes, our women have been enslaved and sold in the markets, you know, for as little as a dollar or a pack of cigarettes. 3,000 Kurdish women still are missing, you know, out of the 6,000, 7,000 that were taken away. Some have died, some we have purchased them back. Yes, the peace of Europe, the peace of America to a certain degree was at stake with these cutthroats blowing up themselves and blowing up, you know, gay clubs or, you know, movie theaters or music concert halls, airports. If we had not fought them, they would have been a greater threat to the West as well as to the region. So our fighting them, unfortunately, we thought it would, you know, earn us some brownie points, if you will, some credit points, but it doesn't look like it. In Iraq, we have been, you know, left to the mercy of the stronger majority Arab population. And even in Syria today, you know, there is this victory in Raqqa. And I hope and pray that the Kurdish gains will not be, you know, sold as change money to the ruling circles in Damascus or in Saudi Arabia or in the conservative government in Turkey, Erdogan. We are going through as a region, not just as Kurds, a troubling time. And we wanted to become, you know, we wanted to be counted among the positive in the region. We wanted to have greater freedom, greater political space. We were not an expansionistic force. Even in Raqqa, it's an Arab city, we have helped liberate it, but the Kurds have no design on Raqqa. We simply want to be in our homeland, you know, historical Kurdish lands, and we want to be alone, left alone, and we want to experiment on this thing called democracy and rule of law and you know, we want to run our own affairs.
Which in Iraq, Kurdish communities have been among the most progressive, you know, leading on women's rights, etc. So do you think that the Iraqi takeover of Kirkuk from and the pushing out of Kurdish forces could lead to another brewing internal conflict inside Iraq between Kurds and Central Arab, you know, Iraqi forces, Arab forces, you know, yet another instability within that country because of what seems to be this sort of violation of the trust between the communities and also in direct response to the referendum?
Well, I'd like to say a couple of things. One is, the constitution of Iraq is based on Islamic law, which we actually don't very much appreciate. You know, we want to have a secular constitution.
Right.
We don't want to, you know, Quran. We'd like to have, you know, the mosque and the state separated the way it's separated in, you know, in much of Europe, in at least constitutionally in this country. So that was an issue of, you know, a problem with us living in under a constitution that you know, sanctified the rule of Quran, if you will, or the verses of Quran. Iraqi Kurdistan compared to Arab Iraq, there is no way to put it. It was much better in the sense that, you know, a lot of refugees, as I said, sought refuge there. A lot of NGOs that wanted to help these refugees have their headquarters in Hawler, in Erbil. They don't have their headquarters in Baghdad, in Basra, because these cities are still not safe. ISIS still, you know, blows up buildings in Baghdad. But thank God the Kurdish security forces inside Kurdistan have managed to have a semblance of freedom, a semblance of freedom of speech, a semblance of rule of law. Not perfect, not like Switzerland, but much better compared to Arab Iraq. And the hope was to make it better and better. That at least is the hope of the Kurds, was hope of the Kurds. Now, with the central government taking over the disputed territories and being supported by Iran, my hunch is they might want to take over completely all of Kurdistan. They might say, well, you know, Kurds are weak and we'll just dominate. In the Middle East, unfortunately, we have this formula called winner take all. We still lack this other formula called, you know, win-win, share. You know, Mahatma Gandhi has a saying. He says, the world has enough for our needs. It doesn't have enough for our greed. Iraq definitely has enough for all the people of Iraq in terms of oil proceeds. And with the right management, with the accountable government, with the transparent government, with a government that believed in sharing, Iraq could be rich again. And Kirkuk could be shared. The Kurds weren't saying that we want to be, you know, completely in charge of Kirkuk. But because it's historically Kurdish and because it's predominantly has a plurality as well as majority Kurdish, they wanted to be in charge of it because they are there, living there. But the central government now, you know, wants to be in charge of it. They brought down the Kurdish flag. They raised the Iraqi flag. The government had a press conference today in Kirkuk. They, you know, banned the Kurdish language until yesterday. Any press conference in Kirkuk was both in Arabic and in Kurdish, you know, respecting the, even the Turkmen, respecting the diversity of the city as well as the, you know, the facts on the ground, if you will. But the signs are not good. I could see flare-ups, more fightings between the Kurds and central government in Baghdad. As far as fighting among the Kurds, between the Kurdish factions, I hope not. I pray not. Between 1994 and 1997, thousands of Kurds died in that civil war. I hope that won't happen, even though, you know, Talabani's faction allowed central government to just basically take over the city, take the city without a fight. I think, you know, we don't know enough, but maybe it was the right thing for the Kurdish, for the other Peshmerga KDP, since they were outmanned and they were surprised to abandon the city. Otherwise, it could have turned into a bloodbath. But it's too early to say these things. I think we still need to know more about what happened.
Right. Well, Kani, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and helping us put these issues into context. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
My guest is Kani Zulam, director of the American Kurdish Information Network. We're talking about recent developments in Kirkuk, Iraq, as well as Raqqa, Syria. This is Rising Up with Sonali. I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can find out more about our program at risingupwithsonali.com. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo.